It's time for Security Now. Steve Gibson is here. In a little bit, we'll cover that PHP malware that the Defense Department says was used against us by the Ruskies. We'll also talk about the FTC going after D-Link. Oh, this is interesting. And why Steve is going to stop using the A word. It's all coming up next on Security Now.
Netcasts you love.
From people you trust.
This is TWiT.
Bandwidth for Security Now is provided by CashFly at CACHEFLY.com. This is Security Now with Steve Gibson, episode 594, recorded Tuesday, January 10th, 2017. A look into PHP malware. Security Now is brought to you by Bowl and Branch. For a good night's sleep, try their ultra-soft, 100% organic cotton sheet sets. Get $50 off your first set of Bowl and Branch sheets and free shipping by visit bowlandbranch.com and entering the code SecurityNow. And by Carbonite. Keep your business safe this year. Protect your business from ransomware and hacker attacks with automatic cloud backup from Carbonite. Try it free at carbonite.com. Use the offer code SecurityNow to get 2 free bonus months if you decide to buy. And by IT Pro TV, an easy, entertaining approach to online IT training. Visit itprotv.securitynow and use the code SN30 for a free 7-day trial and 30% off the lifetime of your account. It's time for Security Now, the show where we cover your security right now. Yeah, with an exclamation mark. That's how right now it is. Here's the guy in charge, Steve Gibson of GRC.com. Live long and prosper, Mr. Gibson.
He's Yo, Leo.
Give me the Vulcan salute with thumbs out, right? That's what we decided?
Thumbs out, yes. Yeah, so we have, I have to get in the habit. Not that I often do the Vulcan salute, so it's not a high demand gesture. But we did learn from Nimoy himself that's the way it should be done. So that's how it shall be done.
Nimoy himself has said.
We said last week that we were going to cover this PHP malware, and I want to, but the Daily Beast has such nice coverage.
Oh, it's Kevin Poulsen. That's why.
Yes, such really good coverage of like what happened with like between reality and the government. That I thought, you know, we got to talk about that too. So that'll be the main topic at the end. And we've got, in the meantime, a bunch of news. We have the FTC finally beginning to step into essentially the world of IoT and home networking malpractice. A fun story about a radio station learning a lesson about what words not to repeat. Mm-hmm. Google has plans to eliminate even the checkbox that we talked about last week with something called an invisible CAPTCHA. Some little quick follow-ups to some things we've been talking about recently. A crucial caveat to the passwords are not long enough argument. More cause to be wary of third-party software downloads, as if we needed any more cause. A few follow-ups to additional things to last week's topics, a little bit of miscellany, and then we're going to talk about this whole sort of across the terrain of this Russian hacking allegations and essentially the way the government for some reason, mishandled the thing as poorly as they did. So I think another great podcast.
Lots to talk about. And happy to say, here we are in the new year. We've got some sponsors for the show. So it means we won't go broke making it.
Good.
Pleased to say.
Broke is bad.
Broke is bad. Broke does not pay the bills. But Bowl and Branch does for this portion of the show. Bowl and Branch is an awesome place to get your next sheets for a good night's sleep. It's nice. Is it just me or is it really one of life's little pleasures? I love it when I change the sheets, and we do it once a week, And I know that night I'm going to get in bed, and it's just going to feel so good, those fresh sheets. And one of the things about staying in a hotel is those fresh sheets every night. They're crisp. They're cool. They feel so good. I'm telling you, the best sheets I've ever slept on, Boll and Branch, like Cotton Boll, B-O-L-L and Branch. And also, you can feel good about it. It's 100% organic cotton. That means they start out soft. They're not there's a lot to this whole, you know, manufacturing of cotton fabric. And I've learned a lot since I've been doing the Boll and Branch ads. For instance, you know, there's some sheets that have this kind of hard crispness to them. These are very soft. A lot of people say, well, what's the thread count? Well, Boll and Branch, and you can see this on the website, it's very clear about this. That is not a good way to judge a sheet. You can have a sheet made with bad cotton that has a very high thread count, and you're not going to like that sheet. Boll and Branch sheets, all I can say is they feel good. They start out super soft. They get softer over time. I've had sheets that I've had to wash like over and over again just to get them close to the softness of a Boll and Branch sheet. Because they use sustainable and responsible methods of sourcing and manufacturing the cotton, you can be very happy about those sheets you're sleeping on. And you get a great price because you're buying direct, wholesale prices. Really good sheets can cost like $1,000 in the store. Boll and Branch sheets, just a couple of $100. And by the way, what a great gift. They come in a beautiful ribboned box. When I got my Boll and Branch sheets, I thought, wow, is this a gift? You wouldn't have to wrap it separately if you gave this as a wedding gift or a household gift. Everyone who tries Boll and Branch loves them. They have thousands of five-star reviews. Forbes, The Wall Street Journal, Fast Company, they're all talking about Boll and Branch. Not just sheets, by the way. Towels, blankets, throws, shams. I don't know what a sham is, but I'm sure somebody does. Sure my wife does. And by the way, three presidents sleep on Boll and Branch. This is a luxury brand. I love the towels too. Here's the deal. Go to BollandBranch.com, BollandBranch, BollandBranch.com, and you'll get $50 off your first set of sheets. They have sheets for children, too. And you know what? If you're going to have a little baby sleeping in a crib, you want to have a really nice sheet for their baby, don't you? Sure you do. Sure you do. I'm telling you, this is a great gift. BollandBranch.com. Just use the promo code SecurityNow, one word, SecurityNow, and you'll get $50 off your first set of sheets. Your first set of sheets. Say that five times fast. Your first set of sheets. BollandBranch.com. The promo code is SecurityNow. They're really good looking. Let me see, can I find the box?
I think sham is like a fancy name for cover, right? Like a pillow sham is a pillow cover.
I don't know.
And normally they have like frilly stuff.
We're
on
the wrong guys to
yeah.
Ask. I don't think we're sham experts. I know sham wow.
Yeah.
I don't think that's what they're talking about. BollandBranch.com. Promo code security now. All right, let's get going here.
So our picture of the week. While you were telling our listeners about Boll and Branch, I was looking more at it, you know, sort of checking the claim that it was authentic. And then I realized you can see the person taking the picture in the background on a Samsung phone, it looks like, because I can sort of see a little bit of that vertical camera silvering that you see and their thumb. Anyway, this is from the This Never Gets Old department. Yet another instance of Windows popping up when you not only least expect it, but really least want it. The caption that was that accompanied this tweet was, "I just wanted some water." And what the picture is, for those who can't see, and it is in the show notes, of course, is it looks like a very high-end, fancy, highly automated refrigerator. I'm not sure what you would need the screen for, though, because you've got three choices down below: water, crushed, and cubed. Meaning, I'm sure, ice, crushed ice and cubed ice. We've got a lock controls and a button to turn the light on. I can't see what the other
buttons are. It's got plenty of buttons, yeah.
They're sort of cropped off. Anyway, the point is that dominating this is upgrading Windows, and it is, at this point, 32% of the way along. And down in sort of blurry, out-of-focus print at the bottom It says installing features and drivers, 6%. So anyway, somebody has embedded Windows in their whatever this is. Looks like maybe a refrigerator.
It could just be an image somebody put on the refrigerator.
They went to some lengths, though, if they wanted to spoof this, because we're picking up a reflection from the upgrading Windows in the upper chrome bezel.
Somebody in the chat room says, you know, it could just be they put a wallpaper on there. They put an image on the screen. You know,
if they had access to the OS in the refrigerator, that would almost be less believable than Windows actually is upgrading itself. I mean, this is what this picture suffers from, is nobody any longer doubts that doubts its authenticity.
Yes, exactly.
You know, I'm getting pictures constantly from people in foreign countries walking by kiosks, that are saying, everywhere. Oh, sorry. We're in the middle of upgrading, and many times they're also sideways for some reason. The screen itself is oriented in a portrait version, but the boot time and the upgrade is still landscape, so it's all twisted sideways. But anyway, so I want to take our listeners through this first piece because the details are what's interesting, and that is the FTC. On the 5th, so last Thursday, in San Francisco federal court, filed a lawsuit against Taiwan-based D-Link Corporation and its U.S. subsidiary, D-Link Systems, Inc., for its failure to take steps to secure their devices, thus leaving them vulnerable to hackers. And I got the complaint and read through it. And what's interesting is it made sense as I was thinking about this. I mean, this is the branch of the federal government that is responsible for protecting consumers and dealing with things like fraudulent claims and fraudulent advertising. And ooh, they really smack it to D-Link in this. So this begins saying plaintiff, the Federal Trade Commission, the FTC, for its complaint brings this action under Section 13 of the Federal Trade Commission Act, 15 U.S.C. Part 53, to obtain permanent injunctive relief and other equitable relief against defendants, meaning D-Link, for engaging in unfair or deceptive acts or practices in violation of Section 5A of the FTC Act, 15 U.S.C. Section 45, in connection with defendants' failure to take reasonable steps to secure the routers and internet protocol cameras they designed for, marketed, and sold to United States consumers. Then there's a bunch of definitions of who's who that I'm skipping. So then under defendants' security failures, it reads, defendants have failed to take reasonable steps to protect their routers and IP cameras from widely known and reasonably foreseeable risks of unauthorized access, including by failing to protect against flaws which the Open Web Application Security Project has ranked among the most critical and widespread web application vulnerabilities since at least 2007. So this sort of gives us a snapshot into their thinking. Among other things, defendants repeatedly have failed to take reasonable software testing and remediation measures to protect their routers and IP cameras against well-known and easily preventable software security flaws, such as hard-coded, it actually says that, hard-coded in quotes, user credentials and other backdoors, and command injection flaws, which would allow remote attackers to gain control of consumers' devices. Defendant D-Link, it reads, has failed to take reasonable steps to maintain the confidentiality, and get a load of this in the details we'll get to in a second, of the private key that defendant D-Link used to sign defendant's software, including by failing to adequately restrict, monitor, and oversee handling of the key, resulting in the exposure of the private key to a public website for approximately 6 months. And defendants have failed to use free software available since at least 2008 to secure users' mobile app login credentials, because they also include an app that allows you to view their IP camera stuff. Instead, have stored those credentials in clear, readable text on a user's mobile device, meaning, you know, no attempt to secure these important credentials. Then under the section, thousands of consumers at risk, the FTC alleges, and this is paragraph 16, I've jumped way down, as a result of defendants' failures, thousands of defendants' routers and cameras have been vulnerable to attacks that subject consumers' sensitive personal information and local networks to a significant risk of unauthorized access. In fact, the press has reported that defendants' routers and cameras have been vulnerable to a range of such attacks and have been compromised by attackers, including by being made part of large-scale networks of computers infected by malicious software known as botnets. The risk that attackers would exploit these vulnerabilities to harm consumers was significant. In many instances, remote attackers could take simple steps using widely available tools to exploit and locate defendants' devices, which were widely known to be vulnerable. For example, remote attackers could search for vulnerable devices over the internet and obtain their IP addresses using readily available tools, such as a popular search engine, and we know what that is, Shodan, that can locate devices running particular software versions or operating in particular locations. Alternatively, attackers could use readily accessible scanning tools to identify vulnerable devices operating in particular areas or on particular networks. In many instances, an attacker could then take simple steps to exploit vulnerabilities in defendants' routers and IP cameras, impacting not only consumers who purchased these devices, but also other consumers who access the internet in public or private locations served by the routers or who visit locations under the IP camera's surveillance. And finally, by creating these vulnerabilities, defendants put consumers at significant risk of harm in a variety of ways. An attacker could compromise a consumer's router, thereby obtaining unauthorized access to consumers' sensitive personal information. For example, using a compromised router, an attacker could redirect consumers seeking a legitimate financial site to a spoofed website. We know that's all too true, where they would unwittingly provide the attacker with sensitive financial account information. Alternatively, using a compromised router, an attacker could obtain consumers' tax returns or other files stored on the router's attached storage device, or could use a router to attack other devices on the local network, such as computers, smartphones, IP cameras, or connected appliances. Similarly, by exploiting the vulnerabilities described in paragraph 15, an attacker could compromise a consumer's IP camera, thereby monitoring consumers' whereabouts to target them for theft or other criminal activity, or to observe and record over the internet their personal activities and conversations, or those of their young children. In many instances, attackers could carry out such exploits covertly, such that consumers would have no reason to know that an attack was ongoing. Finally, during the time defendant's D-Link private key was available on a public website, consumers seeking to download legitimate software from defendants were at significant risk of downloading malware signed by malicious actors using D-Link's private key. So, wow. I mean, this is everything we would want to be aired in court at where we are at this point in time. This is the government saying, hold on a second, you know, here is an egregious, blaring instance of somebody selling equipment with hard to defend irresponsibility. You know, to this point, we've just sort of been shrugging. We've talked about all of these issues in the past and talked about D-Link and all of these problems, but it's just been so, well, you know, at least it won't affect our listeners because our listeners know better, but it's affecting everybody else. So this goes on to then really take D-Link to task. And I won't go through the details, but basically it enumerates D-Link's explicit statements of security, talking about, you know, in their promotional claims, talking about it's how their products are easy to secure, have advanced network security. They even talk about 128-bit security encryption, protects your network with 128-bit AES security encryption, the same technology used in e-commerce or online banking. And so they basically demonstrate that there are all these claims being made on the promotional side, none of which are borne out by years of actual experience, and well after the D-Link absolutely had plenty of time to respond. They were informed of their private key used to sign their firmware being publicly available for months and took no action to remove it or change it. Anyway, this thing just basically shreds them. D-Link's attorneys responded saying that there were, you know, this was without any sort of value. There was nothing to these claims, and you know they would be generating a formal legal response shortly. The second 2/3 of this document, and I have a link to the PDF in the show notes, is all exhibits attached. Snippets from the press, exhibits just, you know, from one end to the other, basically substantiating what the FTC is alleging. And this is the only way I can see that this kind of problem gets resolved is if the FTC, which is, you know, does seem to be the right body, looks at the claims being made, generates a, you know, does the research to pull together the facts that, you know, all of the listeners of this podcast now just sort of take for granted, and says, okay, wait a minute, we're not taking this for granted. This is wrong, and you know, I think we're going to see that 10 years from now, this terrain has changed. Companies won't simply be able to say anything they want to and sell knowingly insecure products into this marketplace. So this is the first step that we've seen of this. I think it's a great way to start off 2017. Wow. So, I've heard you, Leo, talking about I think I first heard you on Sunday saying, okay, we're going to make a pledge on this network.
Not to use the A word.
Not to use the A word.
Or the S word.
Exactly.
Or the G word or the C word.
Exactly. Yes. And I only really tend to talk about the A word.
Okay.
And even in my show notes, I said a radio station learns to be careful when saying
TV. I think it was TV, wasn't it?
CW
Channel 6.
Oh, you're right. Yeah. Right. No, yes. ALEXA So, of course, we know that the perils of automated purchasing are not new. I mean, especially Amazon, who's got those little dash buttons all over the place. You know, the good news is they figured out not to accept another order from a dash button until the previous one arrives. But still, I have a feeling that some households are just going to have toilet paper piling up because it's just, you know, it's there. It wants to be pushed, which, of course, is the brilliance of the whole concept. Anyway, another such instance occurred last week in Dallas, Texas, when a six-year-old asked her family's new Amazon Echo, she said, "Can you play Dollhouse with me and get me a dollhouse?" Hey, it's the household bot. Why not ask it for, you know, what Santa somehow failed to make happen 2 weeks before? So the device, of course, readily complied, ordered a KidCraft Sparkle Mansion dollhouse. In addition to, and I'm not sure how this was connected, 4 pounds of sugar cookies.
There probably was an additional interaction at another time, I'm guessing.
Exactly. Something else. She thought, well, you know, while you're at it. Yeah, while I'm playing with a dollhouse, I might work up an appetite. So the parents, of course, quickly realized that, you know, what had happened, and I guess they weren't able to return them because they donated. I don't know what happened to the cookies, but the dollhouse was donated to a local children's hospital. So that has a nice ending. However, the story was picked up and covered by a San Diego, California news station, CW6. At the end of the story, the anchor, Jim Patton, remarked, he said, quote, "I love the little girl saying," and then he used the A word, "ordered me a dollhouse." According to CW6 News, Echo owners who were watching the broadcast found the remark triggered orders on their own devices across San Diego. Now, the anchor, Jim Patton, didn't think that any of the devices went through with their purchases, although, you know, he would want not to. He told reporters the station had received reports of viewer devices attempting to order a dollhouse after hearing his remarks. So, and of course, we note from a security and technology standpoint that the Echo settings can be adjusted through the device's app. Users can either turn off voice ordering altogether or add a passcode to prevent accidental purchases. So I thought this fit perfectly, Leo, with you know, our New Year's resolution on the Twit Network, not to be glib about using those reserved words, because you can actually get in trouble when people are playing these out loud, and you know, we're within her hearing range.
I'm a little skeptical about all these claims, because at least on mine, it asks me for a PIN code, which I have to enter to confirm it. And that is the default setting. So the only way that this story could really be accurate is if they turn it off,
right,
which if you have a kid is a very bad idea. And then did all the people watching the show also turn it off? I mean, what I suspect happened is, in many cases, and this is what happens if you order something.
Just woke up.
It woke up, it responds, and then puts it on the shopping list, but doesn't actually buy it.
Ah, okay.
So the passcode is on by default. We checked that. So,
good.
I mean, I guess the parents could have turned it off. I don't know.
Yeah, and well, you can imagine that there are, well, we know that. There will be some people who will get annoyed by having to give it a passcode every time. And when they see the option, they think, oh, yeah, we'll just
turn
that off.
Reason to do that. an ad can trigger it. Accidentally, we could be having a conversation. You don't want to trigger sales accidentally. The passcode is a very good idea.
And I had one of those devices.
It's an Echo. It's always been an Echo.
I had an Echo in my living room where I watch television.
Yes, and it will.
And with the volume turned up, it will invariably fire her off every week or so, I she'd suddenly wake up and the little blue ring would sparkle a bit, and I'd go, oh, isn't that interesting? Yeah. But
didn't order anything. The funny thing is, on the one in my office, I've changed the trigger word to echo. So during this whole piece you've been doing, it's triggered twice. So you just can't win. You just can't win. There's three possible trigger words, the A word, but also Amazon or Echo. And, what are you going to do? There's got to be a solution to this.
I imagine, what will happen? So the reason there are only three is that, as we know, they are pre-burned in the firmware. And so there is wide and well-tuned generic voice recognition in the same way that anybody could walk down the street and say, one of those words, and anyone would be able to understand them because we have really good speech recognition built into our brains. Those devices have been carefully tuned to pick up those words without training. The fancy recognition is up in the cloud. And so, as we discussed last week, that word triggers the streaming of a buffer, which then sends it to the cloud for detailed, maybe speaker independent, but also trainable recognition. But anyway, so the point is that my guess is in the future, you'll have much more latitude, maybe complete latitude, where in the same way that we train our fingerprint readers on our smartphones by giving them lots of samples of our thumb many times, and it builds up a composite image, you could train whatever you wanted as the trigger word by saying it over and over and over a number of times, in a number of different situations, different distances, different volumes and pitches.
It's not the future. It's the past, unfortunately. The Moto X allowed you to do that. You could have any arbitrary trigger word. And so I actually, I forgot what mine was, something like open the pod bay doors, howl, or, but, made it long, complex, and not likely to happen by accident. But they did it, and they don't do it anymore, and no one else has done it. So I don't know. It's more challenging, obviously. You have to train it.
And I remember seeing you sometimes not getting it respond.
Right.
And so that's what you don't want. You don't want false negative responses. Neither do you want false positives. So I think it's that situation where we didn't quite have the horsepower needed to pull it off well enough for it not to be more trouble than it's worth. Yeah. So with today's horsepower, we can, they're able to build very good recognition for a few words so that it will very reliably trigger. My guess is that downstream, once we're on the A27 chip from, I guess that's Apple, not Echo, but, the equivalent, then we'll have more horsepower and you'll probably be able to just say, hey, this is what I want. This is the phrase I want to use in order to wake you up. And then we'll be in much better shape. It'd be like everybody having the same password right now. It's just not a good idea. So, speaking of passwords, some listener, thank you, sent this to me. I wouldn't have stumbled on it myself. It's you can Google Invisible ReCAPTCHA, and you will find it. It is in beta. It is not yet released. The show notes have a nice picture of the screen you get when you bring up Invisible CAPTCHA or ReCAPTCHA. And following from what we talked about, it was the end of our podcast last week, this notion of, how can just checking a checkbox differentiate you between being human and a bot? And what we understood was that the original concept of a self-contained test was what was at fault in the very first CAPTCHAs, because unfortunately, computers learn to read. And if they couldn't, then you could outsource this to sweatshops in other countries and you'd have human beings reading for you in order to get these little problems solved. So the proper solution, which we discussed last week, is for if you are a company in a position to have a huge amount of background associated with a user, and Google, if nothing else, is that company, then you're not just bringing, it's like, solve this little puzzle to bear. You're bringing, oh, you're logged into Gmail in the background or any Google property. We've got your cookie. We see your IP from which the query is being made. We know everything you've been doing all morning, all of the previous day, and so forth. Oh, and we know that this is a site that you tend to visit. You've done so, you know, 26 and a half times, because once you were in a hurry and you didn't bother scrolling, in the last year. So the point is, with all of that knowledge, why even bother with a checkbox? And they've been incrementally moving in that direction. And it's in beta now. Developers can use it. We'll be seeing it before long. They simply remove the CAPTCHA completely from the screen. And it's called the invisible reCAPTCHA. They have three ways to invoke this. You can have a web page that loads automatically bind the challenge, as they call it, to your own button, or you can programmatically bind the challenge to a button, both of which just mean that you can, when you're designing your page, you can have your own, you know, press here to confirm you're not a bot. And so it's your own button, not the fancy rendered, you know, reCAPTCHA, you know, logoed thing, just your own. And behind the screens, that button is invoking a snippet of JavaScript, which is sourced from Google and sends the query to Google that allows it to do its work to determine if it believes that this assertion you've just made. The other thing you can do is you can programmatically invoke the challenge, meaning that just loading the page can run the JavaScript, perform the query, and return to code on the page a go-no-go assertion about whether the person who is viewing this page is or is not a bot without the user doing anything, which is, you know, the ultimate of what we want. So essentially, this is a perfect example of us having sort of passed through a problem that over time, over the course of what, maybe 6 or 7 years, continued to evolve until essentially network externalities were able to be brought to bear so that the whole problem just went away. Now, it's, again, not everyone can do this with the reliability that Google is bringing, because not all remote properties have the opportunity to create this kind of knowledge. Arguably, Facebook probably also does. But you want somebody that's going to be, you know, that's going to have enough depth that they're going to be able to do this. And, you know, let's remember also that there is something Google is getting in return for this. For a while, when we were solving images for them, especially when we were doing those, the one known word and the one unknown word, that's the first time we talked about CAPTCHAs back in the day, was we were actually digitizing ebooks for Google. Remember that the idea would be they would verify that we were doing not a nonsense problem solve by presenting a word they did know the answer to, and then also would present one they did not know the answer to, and we typed in both words, and in the process performed a little bit of OCR for this big project that was running behind the scenes. So anyway, essentially. This problem is gone now. Oh, but I was going to say that, remember that our browser is telling Google where we are and that it is we who are there. So in the same way that Facebook's like button is while it's convenient, it's also an explicit tracking beacon. So is the ubiquitous presence of this very nice recapture technology. It's all going back as essentially a tracking flag, although lots of pages already have Google Analytics on them anyway. So they're getting that information that way, even if they weren't performing this nice service for us. So I expect that in a while, we'll just stop seeing explicit requirements to declare or prove that we're human. And somehow the system will just know. And of course, now we know how that's happening. I found an interesting post that reminded me that I needed to clarify something from our discussion last week about brute forcing passwords. Remember that we talked about Brutalis, which was this monster multiple GPU, triple redundant power supply, 3U high rack mounted, you know, industrial strength cracking machine that this company was selling throughout the world to governments and law firms that wanted access to, you know, that basically wanted, you know, anybody who wanted to be able to brute force passwords for whatever purpose. And the argument there was that the guy who had designed this, who had very deep understanding of that the difficulty of password cracking of high entropy passwords, was sort of bemoaning the fact that he was seeing people complaining that 16 characters, you know, wasn't enough. And in fact, he was aware of our discussion and sent me a tweet saying, hey, you know, thanks for the shout out about our work. So this post asks the question and answers it. Why are he says 12 plus, you know, 12 or more character passwords vulnerable? And he writes, practically speaking, people who manually create passwords above 10 characters, for the most part, use common words or phrases. Why do they do this? Because remembering the password horse battery 123 is way easier than capital G, capital F, lowercase j, 27, lowercase e, f, 8% sign, k, dollar sign, 39. Now, I read that on purpose because also notice how much more difficult it is even for me to say it than horse battery 123. The fact that I can say horse battery 123 as quickly as I can demonstrates its lack of entropy. It's the fact that horse is a thing.
It's organized. Battery, it's organized.
Yes, exactly. Battery is a thing. And
I
one,
wish
two,
he'd
three.
Never. I love him, but I wish he'd never done that cartoon.
Yeah, XKCD.
Yeah, because it comes up all the time.
I know.
Everybody's convinced because he's usually right. Randall. I know his name, Randall. I can't remember. He's usually right, but this one's not.
So he says it's just the author of this post is just simple human behavior exhibiting path of least resistance that will always exist. And until auto-generating password managers gain mass adoption, this vulnerability will always be around. He says, I agree that XKCD's password strength cartoon for four random words is sound, but only for non-fast hashing algorithms like bcrypt. And then he finishes, in this article, we will demonstrate combo and hybrid attacks using Hashcat that will expand your cracking knowledge toolkit. These examples will show how an attacker can efficiently attack this larger key space with modern hardware and make these so-called strong passwords succumb to his cracking methodology, his meaning the attacker's cracking methodology. And I won't go any further. I have the link in the the link to this in the show notes. But what he does is he goes through exactly these examples, like horse battery 123, and he uses Hashcat with parameters because it includes a dictionary that has, for example, the word horse and the word battery in it. And there, so you can parameterize the invocation of Hashcat to tell it how you want it to guess. And he does this with all manner of the typical passwords that people are using, which even though they may be 12 or more characters long, his demo, he shows you screenshots with the timer. In 5 hours, bang, got that one. In 3.5 minutes, bang, got that one. In a few hours, bang, got that one. So what I wanted to make sure people understood was that that second example that took me 30 seconds just to utter, as opposed to horse battery 1, 2, 3, that one, that's part of the requirement of 12 characters or certainly 16 being enough. That is, and I did say it, but I want to make sure it was heard. It has to be a high entropy password. That is, it has to be something that either you roll dice literally in order to choose, or you went to GRC's passwords.htm page, or you used your password manager's random number generator to produce a string. People just can't do it reliably. We have an inherent bias. There will be a pattern. Even if we try to generate 10 in a row, they will get linked. So anyway, I just want to make sure that in discussing why passwords didn't have to be 128 characters long to be good, they can be shorter, but they absolutely need to be high entropy. And I also did not mention that the use of, on the server end, on the back end, a password-based key derivation function is crucial. That's the thing that is deliberately time-consuming. It takes what the user provides and doesn't just do an MD5 or an SHA-1 or an SHA-256. Even though SHA-256 is very nice, we now, thanks to so many cryptocurrencies now using that, we've got hardware that just cuts through SHA-256, which isn't to say 256 bits isn't a lot. That's still a lot. But it does allow you to do brute force guessing at incredibly high speeds. So the point is, you can't just do a single iteration of SHA-256. You have to iterate it. You have to arrange to make it difficult to accelerate. And of course, that's what password-based key derivation functions are all about doing. So high entropy doesn't have to be super long, and we want the server on the back end to protect us. The problem, of course, is we don't know. We have no control as users on what's going on over on the back end of this. So all we can do is choose something that's pure gibberish and have it be, you know, as long as we're comfortable with and as the website will accept, and hope for the best. For a couple of weeks now, I've been seeing a mention of something that I hadn't picked up on, but we had time this week, so I wanted to note it. A chat protocol, which is in many ways the granddaddy of chat protocols, XMPP. It's been around for like almost 15 years. I believe the author began working on it in the late 1990s. It was originally known as Jabber and then got renamed XMPP, which stands for Extensible Messaging and Presence Protocol. The reason it's on Security Now's radar is it has recently received an extension called OMemo, which gives it end-to-end encryption and support for encrypted group messaging. So for those who don't know, it's an XML-based, so text-based messaging platform. That's sort of a mixed blessing. The text-basedness means that it is easy to extend, and in fact that it's been extended crazily. There's a whole bunch of standards. There's about four anchoring RFCs that define the protocol, which, because it's of its age, have been replaced and extended several times by successive RFCs. It enables near real-time exchange of structured yet extensible data between any two or more network entities. It's not strong on binary sharing because it is a text-based protocol, which would require that you Base64 encode any binaries that you want to send from point to point, which of course makes them about 50% larger, which means that you're going to have – it's going to be slower than a protocol that incorporates an understanding of native binary attachments or content as part of it. XMPP / Jabber doesn't have that. But it was designed to be extensible. And as I mentioned, that the extensions are numbered and you almost – it's hard to count them. There are just so many of them. This, I mean, which is really a nice aspect of this for someone that we want to be able to evolve over time. And in fact, OMemo is an extension added to the existing framework without the underlying protocol needing to be changed at all. And so it's, you know, it's in active use. There are about 10 million users of this as of 2003. So I don't know if it's gone up or down since then.
Because unfortunately, it was a protocol for Google Talk.
And they abandoned it.
So I was really disappointed. I have very high hopes for XMPP. We wanted to use XMPP for all sorts of things, for our chat and so forth. But when Google deprecated it, it was the end of the line. I mean, Jabber is still used from time to time, but it's sad because that would have been a universal protocol.
Yes.
And now we just have all these silos that are incompatible with one another. And
exactly.
In fact, I'm really sad because now that they've added encryption, it would have been a really good choice for chat and stuff. But
yeah. Well, and, you know, it does exist. There is a nice client called Conversations for Android. And, you know, I mean, there are clients for all platforms. OMemo is a recent – it essentially – OMemo took OTR, which is the off-the-record protocol that we've discussed in the past, and added to that multi-user chat and multi-device support, meaning devices owned by a single user. And OMemo is inspired and based upon Open Whisper Systems. I have practiced pronouncing this before, and now here at the moment I can't. The axolotl protocol, which we've talked about extensively, which was developed for Signal. So it's based on the axolotl ratchet, which is the way you do this kind of protocol securely. It's not backwards compatible with OTR, but it is, that is OMemo, is being standardized as the new end-to-end encryption mechanism on XMPP. So that's what everyone's going to be using. You need no server-side support. That is, the XMPP server just sort of serves as the hub for conversations, and it's only the clients that need to know that, you know, how to understand this extension. It's XEP-0280 is the number. So it needs no server side support. And there are other chat protocols, other secure chat protocols in development, OTR version 4 and one called N1SEC. But it looks like this one is here now and has a lot of client side support. There's Conversations that I mentioned on Android. Is it Gagim? G-A-G-I-M?
I don't know. Gagim.
Probably. CryptoCat, of course, we've talked about on iOS, Android, Mac, Linux, and Windows. Chat Secure on iOS and Android. These all support XMPP. These are XMPP clients that now support OMemo. Monil on iOS and Mac. The Tor Messenger on Linux, Windows, and Mac. Instant Bird. Jitsi, which is a Java-based platform, Let's Chat, and Pigeon on Windows and Linux. So anyway, I just sort of wanted to put it on our listeners' radar. I know that within our group, there are, you know, people who are, you know, still refuse to be on Twitter and would, you know, probably like the idea. You can set up your own XMPP server. There are, you know, Jabber.org exists. There are both free and very inexpensive commercial services where you can get an account. And then, you know, if you have a reason for doing group chat, XMPP is there, and now it can be secure. It's got the same problems that you're always going to have with authentication. So you need to go through that step of making sure that the key of someone you think you're talking to is actually their key, but it has provisions for that. And once you get it up and going, it's apparently very easy to use and solid. So anyway, just for if anyone wants to, you know, roll their own essentially, and also use an RFC-based, standards-based, open, you know, everything's there to inspect. Everything's on GitHub. There are links to GitHub in many of the clients that I was talking about. So it's another way to go with and still have security.
Yeah. The guys who did, I think, XChat, two of the chat clients, IRC chat clients, are also talking about doing their own encrypted encryption scheme. Everybody realizes the importance of encryption now, and they want to put it everywhere.
Yep. Yeah, I just think we're in early days, Leo.
Yeah,
this will end up getting sorted out.
Yeah.
You know, and it'd be like somebody trying to come along and do HTTPQ or something. It's like,
Not now.
Yeah. Sorry.
Let's not. Hey, let's take a little break, and then we'll come back with Perfect. More. I also have a question for you. While we're on the break, we can do this in another show or whatever, but we had a caller on the radio show with a great question. And I said, I don't know. I'm going to ask Steve. His insurance company sent him a encrypted document. And by the way, they put the words encrypted in quotes that contained all sorts of personal information. They said, we're going to send it to you via email. And, it'll be secure. So he got it and clicked on it. And it opened up an envelope style window, which we've seen with other encryption programs. So it can't be stolen via, I don't know, Tempest or something. You know, it's Tempest Secure, but I don't know why they do that. But anyway, and then it said, if you want to read the message, enter your name and your email address and create a password. So he did, and then they saw the message in the clear in this envelope window. And he thought, well, but I wonder. So he said, I had it sent to another email address, entered a new name, email, and password, and it was in the clear. And he said, well, this doesn't seem very secure to me. And I said, yeah, that doesn't sound all that secure to me.
You are 100%
either.
Correct.
That's a little
of you.
Odd.
So
it's a big financial services company. It's AXA, AXA.
Yeah.
And they're doing their own encryption. I thought, well, maybe that's just DocuSign or some other system. My guess is the password rigmarole is merely for an audit trail on their own side.
Yeah.
So that you can establish an account.
It sounds like what they did was they obfuscated the file.
I'm sure the attachment's a JavaScript stub that pulls a file from a server, I would guess. It's very strange. I will send you a link to their page explaining their secure encryption in quotes. And maybe you can. I just thought if there's a way that this is encrypted, I don't know what it is, but maybe Steve could tell.
No, and the problem, of course, is that he tested it. He used, you know, they didn't give him credentials.
No, there was no previous exchange of credentials. Make up your own password.
Wow.
And he tried it twice.
Wow.
Yeah. It didn't seem like a very good idea.
What was the address of the FTC? Where are they?
Yeah, really. But this is a huge. This AXA, AXA is huge. This is not, you know, some little tiny. He said they've got a big building downtown in New York City. It's part of Equitable Life Insurance Company.
Yeah, so does D-Link.
Yeah, they got to build a big building somewhere. All right, our show today brought to you by Carbonite. I will tell you one thing every security expert says, that one of the, and it's kind of counterintuitive, but you hear it all the time. The best thing you can do, get a good backup. Because you know what? If you do get compromised or something bad happens or malware gets on your system, very often the only real good solution is just wipe your system, right? And then having a good backup of your data will be come in handy. But there's another even more, you know, pernicious thing happening these days with ransomware. Ransomware is everywhere. 90% of all phishing attacks now have ransomware viruses in it because it's very profitable. Did you see the LA Valley College, LAVC, just paid $28,000 in Bitcoin? $28,000 in Bitcoin because they got bit by ransomware. And every time I read that, I go, but didn't they have a backup? I mean, really? Their independent security expert determined it would be cheaper probably for them to pay the $28,000 than to recover their data. Maybe they should have taken a look at Carbonite. That sounds a little outrageous to me. Carbonite's great for you. It's great for your business. It's automatic, continuous offsite backup. There's a great white paper on Carbonite's website under the resources section of how Carbonite helps protect you against ransomware because it does versioning and it will back up. Even if your encrypted files get backup, you'd still be able to go back a version. It's really a great system. Every backup plan should include at least one off-site copy. Now, you can do what Steve does and mail CDs to your mom, but you don't do that still, do you?
No. I have multiple locations now, mailed them to myself.
Yeah. Well, off-site's good. I mean, it's important. And, you know, frankly, the cloud works really well, too. Try it now. Carbonite.com. It's a free trial, and there's no credit card needed. So that means really free. They don't have any way of charging you. And you'll have to give them a credit card, though, if you decide to buy. And you may want to because it's very affordable. You pay a flat rate. They have plans for home, for office, for Mac, for PC. And if you use the offer code SECURITYNOW when you sign up, one word, SECURITYNOW, you'll get 2 months free with your purchase. I say it all the time. You got to back it up to get it back. So do it right with Carbonite. Can you believe that? $28,000.
Wow. Mom will be 90 in March.
Don't send her your CDs.
No, she would put them in the DVD player and try to watch them.
Wow, you've got good genes. She's 90 next March. That's awesome.
Yeah, still going strong. So.
That is awesome.
In fact, she was complaining that she's had a little bit of a problem with macular degeneration.
Oh,
and
it's hard
she's
to read.
She's been using Kindles that I provided her with years ago.
Yeah,
so
yeah.
At Christmas, I said, Mom, I want to show you an alternative. And so I brought up the Kindle software on my iPad. She says, oh, honey, I don't know what warp drive is, but I can read that.
Oh,
and
nice.
So anyway, that's going to be her birthday present as I'm going to go up and get her set up with an iPad for her for reading. Because she just loves to read.
I set up mom with two Echoes.
Yeah.
And she now listens to audiobooks, which she loves.
Nice.
Yeah. Yeah.
So I got a couple tweets that I wanted to share. Our friend of the show, Simon Zarafa, shared a tweet both with Paul Thurrott and me from someone named Kevin Beaumont, who he said, he's laughing. He says, ah, ha, ha, ha. Just found a Windows 10 install ISO on BitTorrent.
Oh, that'll be
which includes a scheduled task to download and run a ransomware exe after 90 days.
Oh, nice. Yeah, so let's get some data on there and then encrypt it.
Exactly. Smart. Exactly. Wait 3 months and then lock it up.
Wow.
Yes. Yeah, so, like, again, you know, Microsoft will pay you to download their Windows 10 install ISO. So, you know, don't go get it somewhere else. And actually, the same thing is true. I have a little comment later about GRC's DNS bench because somebody apparently found what was like trying to figure out what was going on and did some Googling. And there was a malware site that showed that the file data from DNS, ostensibly from DNS Bench, that had all the fields empty, you know, like file version, file name, original name, publisher, and so forth. Well, of course, my software has all the files filled in and is digitally signed. So this is the problem is that when something becomes popular, people, bad guys take the opportunity to bundle malware as that thing and get people to run it without knowing any better. So you know, be just, you know, and this, especially with the death of download sites, they've just pretty much become worthless. Again, it's a nice era we went through, but it's died. Another tweet that raised a good point. I just wanted to follow up also from last week. James P. tweeted, "When I see password length limits on websites, it makes me wonder if they're not hashing the password on the back end." And I did forget to mention that last week. You know, again, people are complaining when websites say, you enter your password no more than X characters. And so on one hand, you know, I immediately jumped on that as, oh, well, they're upset because it's not allowing them longer passwords. When in fact, a very reasonable concern that James raises is that, well, the fact that they even care about the length does worry us that they have a fixed amount of space in their database record for the user's password in the clear. So they're not doing anything with it except storing it, which reminds me of a little giggle I had when I was up with Yubico demonstrating them the squirrel, the whole, you know, doing the whole run through of the squirrel technology, and of course showing them a demo, because of course I had to have a password length limit of 256 characters. And it says that on the field, you know, username, because I support traditional login and then side-by-side squirrel login. Anyway, the point is that they noticed in a light gray type below the field, I said, you know, password up to 256 characters. And one of them said, who has a password of 256 characters? I said, well, nobody. But the point is, it can be anything. So
it's, you know, like encouraging there, you make it longer, right? Yeah.
Yeah, exactly. And I, of all people, have to have a virtually unlimited password length because, you know, everyone should.
So the point being, once something's hashed, the result of the hash is always the same length.
Yes.
That's short.
Yes.
Or relatively short. How long is it?
Yeah, 256 bits.
Oh, okay.
And so, but if you divide that by 8, what do you get? 32? So it's only 32 characters.
It's not bad.
Yeah. Okay, and lastly, Aaron Bishop provided some interesting addition to our dialogue about the Apple's ATS security issue. Remember we talked last week how Apple had announced at the WDC 2016 in last summer that there would be a sunset on the ATS workaround where with iOS 9, it was there and everybody should use it, but developers could turn it off. And they said, we're going to stop allowing you to submit new iOS apps that turn it off at the beginning of 2017. They backed away from that. Well, Aaron wrote, I'm an app developer who links to third-party websites and have had issues with ATS on some sites because they don't allow any ECDHE cipher suites. Okay, that's elliptic curve Diffie-Hellman ephemeral. And we've talked about that a long time ago. Elliptic curve, of course, we know is the faster, shorter keys, strong security. Diffie-Hellman is the so-called Diffie-Hellman key agreement, which is the way you negotiate in public a private key where a bad guy can see a whole dialogue going back and forth, but still can't figure out what key you guys agreed to, even though he saw all of the conversation. And then ephemeral is really the key. That's why Apple is enforcing this. And that is that it is not a persistent, long-lived key. It is ephemeral, as the word says. It is being negotiated on the fly on a per connection basis, which gives you perfect forward secrecy, meaning that if anyone were ever to get any one key, it wouldn't help you either with future or previous to decrypt future or previous conversation. So he goes on, ATS only allows for ECDHE. And my guess is that the sites don't allow it either because they haven't updated and modified their cipher suites, or they're afraid of lawsuits for using elliptic curve crypto. And we covered that like about a year ago, that there was a patent troll that had sued a whole bunch of large sites saying that, you know, they had a patent on an elliptic curve crypto. It's like, okay, well, we haven't had any. I've been looking for more news of that, but I haven't seen anything. Anyway, he finishes, just thought you might like to know, since I haven't heard anything about ATS requiring elliptic curve Diffie-Hellman ephemeral with regards to patent lawsuits. Right. I don't know if ECDHE falls under that patent, but the keywords are enough for a chilling effect. So I certainly agree with Aaron on that point, and I agree. I didn't realize, so this is why I wanted to share it and bring it up, is that ATS enforces ECDHE. Well, that is relatively new, and it is the case that not all sites are supporting it, even when they do support TLS 1.2 or 1.3 and lots of the other very recent cipher suites. So that I would argue that was a little aggressive on Apple's part. It would have been nice maybe if they'd staged that, if they'd said, you got to have TLS and we'll give you another year for it to be ECDHE. Because after all, most of the world is not on ECDHE yet. We're still using earlier cipher suites, which are universally available. So anyway, Aaron, thank you for providing that from a developer standpoint. And two last points. One is, and I've been meaning to mention this for a couple weeks because this is a few weeks old now. Many people have noted this, and I finally, when I was putting things together, I said, okay, I'm not going to forget again. This was via a Twitter DM. A listener said, "Hi, Steve, just got an email from Cox." He said, "Seems to be from them based on the header." So he was skeptical. Good. He says, "As I write this, it might be your DNS benchmark triggered this." And in fact, I'm sure of it. Cox has an email they're sending out to people who have used GRC's DNS benchmark. It reads, "Cox has identified that one or more of the computers behind your cable modem are likely infected with the Zeus Trojan bot, also known as ZBot." And it goes on, but that's the headline. So he says, "My first question is, how can Cox see what's behind our modem? We're running NAT routers. Second, the only thing that changed over the past day is that I replaced our previous routers with Linksys running DDWRT, and he says, aka Tomato. Could DNS mask be causing this false positive?" And he says, "Oh, I also ran your DNS name server benchmark the other night and rebuilt our list of name servers. Perhaps that unusual traffic was it. Third, when did Cox start caring if a keylogger is installed on one of our computers? Again, how could Cox know? Is Cox seeing a bunch of data coming out of our router all of a sudden?" And then he says, he ends saying, "Perhaps DNS benchmark would do that." And he's absolutely right. A number of people have reported that they've received such an email from Cox. Clearly, there is a one-to-one correspondence between using the DNS benchmark and receiving this note. So what has apparently happened is about a month ago, just judging, or maybe at the beginning of the year, it's longer than that. I think I got some at the end of 2016. Cox decided to get proactive, which is a good thing, in looking at their subscribers' traffic. And again, I just think that's all for the better, that we wish more ISPs would be more proactive. Unfortunately, running the benchmark does look like, if you didn't look too carefully, like you're using you are generating a DNS reflection attack, because a DNS reflection attack sends a bunch of little queries off to a whole bunch of different DNS servers, and with a spoofed source IP. Now, of course, the source IP is not spoofed, so they could be a little smarter about this and see that, in fact, what's actually happening is a bunch of valid DNS queries, spewing out from a given client. So, you know, the only one they would ever be DOSing would be themselves. And of course, the benchmark is very careful about metering those so that you don't saturate your own bandwidth, because one of the things that the benchmark does is check the reliability of the DNS servers. So I wouldn't want to saturate the connection, or we'd cause packets to be dropped and get false positives on low reliability that I was careful not to do. So anyway, for anybody else who has received this letter from Cox and has shot me a note, but I never responded, I'm absolutely sure that there is a correlation. And it doesn't seem that everything goes further. Nobody's had their traffic cut off. Cox is just, you know, providing them with a warning. And that does demonstrate that on a per subscriber basis, Cox has deployed technology to notice if the behavior of their subscribers indicates that they may be infected. So although it's a false positive for, you know, that occurs when you run the DNS benchmark, it does say that we're seeing some positive movement in this direction from a major internet connectivity provider. And then this is just random, but I thought this was interesting. The first country is beginning to phase out FM radio. So this is from the way things were department. Leo, you're a couple of years younger than me, but you probably remember like when FM was new.
Yeah,
yeah,
it was a big deal. Yeah,
yeah, and it
sounded
like,
so good.
Oh, so much better. Yes.
It was stereo.
So yes, exactly. And so of course we have AM, which stood for amplitude modulation, where a high frequency carrier has its amplitude modulated. That is, the amplitude fluctuates, and that fluctuation is the audio signal that it rides on the carrier. The problem with that is that all kinds of other things could cause, like interference, could cause the amplitude to be modulated for other than the audio. That's why AM is not as good as FM. FM is frequency modulation, where instead of changing the amplitude of this high frequency carrier, you subtly tweak the frequency, which actually amounts to the instantaneous phase of the sine wave that is being broadcast. And it's, although you can have problems with reflections, frequency modulating is far more noise resistant than amplitude modulation between the transmitter and the receiver. Thus, FM was like way better. 2 years ago, Norway announced they were going to formally phase out FM radio. And at this point, about 70% of the population has the replacement already, DAB, digital audio broadcasting. And I guess for whatever reason, FM, I mean, like for reason of the terrain, actually, in Norway, FM is just, it's difficult to get coverage.
Oh, that's apparently interesting. So that would make sense, yeah.
Yes. Apparently, there are only 5 FM stations as is, and DAB allows them within the same bandwidth to get 20.
Ah.
So there are 20 DAB broadcasts and only 5 terrestrial FM.
Very different here. I mean, this is a very different terrain. Yeah.
Yes.
Yeah.
And so the Norwegian government estimated then and has updated their estimate, saying they expect that corporate entities there are, but they expect $23.5 million to be saved annually by the stations switching over. people are, of course, reluctant to do this. 60% of the people recently polled said, no, we'd rather, you know, just keep what we have. But sorry. So this week, the first FM station went dark. They're going to be blanking them out geographically over the course of the year, and there will be FM radio free by the end of 2017. And really, the only losers are there are about 2 million autos on the road in Norway that still have FM radios and don't yet have DAB, this digital audio broadcasting. So there's been a concern that, lack of broadcast communications for, highway traveling vehicles could pose a safety hazard. You know, cars should have some way of receiving notification of problems. But, everybody's going to have phones and things now, too. So I don't know that that's a big problem. The radio.no, if anyone is curious, is a Norwegian webpage for the association and the country. And it's all in Norwegian until you get about three quarters of the way down. And then there's I could read English finally. I can't tell most of what it's saying, but this is happening. So, the UK has talked about doing this too. And so it does look like in the long term, we may be seeing FM go the way of the dodo bird, but probably not soon.
You know, most phones sold outside the U.S. have FM radios built into them. And the same hardware in the U.S. could do it, but it's disabled by the carriers, who would far prefer you use data and pay them than listen to free radio.
Free music? Wait a minute.
There is a movement from the National Association of Broadcasters in the United States trying to force these companies to turn those FM radios on for safety reasons, if nothing else.
Right.
Internet goes down, your cell network goes down, you'd still be able to receive a radio broadcast.
Yep.
I'd hate to see – I don't think I think it's a non-starter in the U.S., although it reminds me a lot of how the FCC forced television stations to go from analog broadcast
precisely
to digital to conserve, spectrum.
Right.
And resell that really precious spectrum they owned and make billions of dollars.
In fact, I sort of assumed that's what was going on. It was like, why force existing infrastructure to go dark when it's already there and it's been amortized, I'm sure, and paid for, except maybe to recover the bandwidth.
Right.
But it looks like they're repurposing it with a digital technology that will give them,
more
for
same frequencies.
More for the same bandwidth, yes.
Analog spectrum is limited, obviously.
Yeah.
But digital use of spectrum probably is not unlimited, but it's effectively much – it's almost unlimited. Much better.
Right. Well, think about what comes over a cable.
Right.
It's just astonishing.
Right.
It's just astonishing.
Right. You can see why they would want to do that.
Oh, yeah. So I got a nice note from a follower, Glacier Pilot, with a interesting and something yet again we haven't ever talked about Spinrite. He said, "Hey Steve, a Spinrite story for you. I built a RAID 10 recently. Okay, now RAID 10, that's a combination of a 1 and a 0. So a RAID 0 is where you span a volume across two drives. A RAID 1 is where you mirror a volume across two drives for redundancy. And of course, spanning gives you size. So a RAID 10 is both. It is essentially two drives are spanned in RAID 0 and then duplicated to another two drives to give you RAID 1 for each drive, resulting in RAID 10, RAID 1-0, sort of both. So he said, I built a RAID 10 recently using four identical brand new Western Digital Black Caviars. To my surprise, the RAID went critical twice in 2 weeks, shortly after. And then he said, interestingly, the drives didn't have a problem rebuilding. He says, therein lays a clue. Naturally, he says, I was disappointed since the drives were new. Since I thought I might have to fight Western Digital over RMAs, you know, return merchandise authorizations, I decided to run SpinRite so I could document bad sectors or any other problems. I started out running level 3, but SpinRite reported that would take 3 days at that level, so I ran level 2 to cut it down to 1. Surprisingly, no bad sectors reported, and smart data was good too. But more importantly, after running the drives through SpinRite at level 2, no more critical RAID errors. I think what's happening is similar, he writes, with what SSD guys are finding. If I have it right, a RAID controller waits a certain amount of time for a drive to acknowledge a write is complete. If the drive takes too long, say, due to a sector relocation, then the controller assumes the drive has failed and takes it offline and marks the RAID critical. He says, ostensibly, the WD Red NAS drives mitigate this in their firmware. By running a drive through SpinRite at level 2, any questionable sectors are exercised out, and voila, the RAID has not failed since. So, yet another happy and somewhat inexplicable way that SpinRite makes hard drives better. It's from my standpoint, you can imagine I'm a little frustrated because drives have become so sophisticated that they have become black boxes. The manufacturers consider the details proprietary, that, you know, and with good reason, I think, because they are magic in like the amount of storage that you're able to get in such a small space. But, you know, as the SpinRite developer, I would dearly love to have visibility into exactly what's going on. I could do so much more, as I did once upon a time back when there were no controllers in drives, when the controller was separate and it had to be documented in order for software to talk to it. So essentially what's happened is SpinRite has evolved into a very intolerant exerciser of the lowest common denominator. That is, okay, if all we can rely on is this is a black box and we're going to give it data and get it back, we're going to be really, really, really picky about that. And so, of course, SpinRite does put the drive into a bunch of special maintenance modes to turn off retries, to shut down error correction, and to force the drive to operate without a lot of the bells and whistles, then makes it do that and helps to show the drive it has problems that it was rather kind of preferring to ignore. Once you run it through that process, then turn all that stuff back on again, you're back to a drive with all the bells and whistles, but also with some of the, you know, the fluff and debris and dust bunnies brushed off to the side. And it works.
Let us pause because I'm very interested. We talked about the JAR report last week. We've been talking about it a lot on Russian hacking. Yep. And how nonsensical it was. And Kevin Poulsen, I think, really did us all a favor by explaining what the real evidence is. I don't understand why the intelligence agencies did such a hash of this. And that's just – we'll have to leave that to speculation. But they did bring up this very interesting PHP malware, which we're going to dissect. Steve will dissect. I will watch. If you need any tools or anything, just ask. I'll hand them to you. But you're going to do the dissection in just a moment.
Okay.
First, a word from our sponsor, IT Pro TV. We know you listen to this show. You are a geek. You are a full bore, go for it kind of a geek. Maybe you're even already in IT, or maybe you'd like to get in an IT because this is your favorite thing and you want to do it for a living. Well, if you're either of those, you're going to love IT Pro TV. It is a TV station. It's kind of like Twit for IT. So it's a TV station. It runs all day, Monday through Friday. Lots of courses. Whether you're keeping your skills up to date or you want to get new certs, 2,000 hours of content, 30 hours every week, Monday through Friday, 9 to 5, they're on. And you can stream them live or on demand to your Chromecast, to your Roku, to your Amazon Fire, your Apple TV. They've got great apps. The Apple TV app's fabulous. Or your PC. Courses include everything you'd want to study, from certified information security systems security professional to CompTIA Project Plus to ethical hacking V9. They were the first I knew of to do the ethical hacking courses, and I just love these courses. Upcoming, CompTIA's Cybersecurity Analyst Plus. You love this stuff already. What a great job. And talk about job security. Man, if you're in this, man, you know it. You got it. CCNA Cyber Ops, Understanding Cisco Cybersecurity Fundamentals, another great skill. ITIL, Operational Support and Analysis, Microsoft System Center, and on and on and on. They've got great transcriptions. I know a lot of people read Steve's transcriptions. Same thing for IT Pro TV. Really well-done transcripts, so you can jump to any part of the video, follow along. 100 step-by-step virtual machine labs, the Transcender practice exams. They're worth $109, but they're free. Look at this certified ethical hacking course. I really want to take this. 33 hours and 37 minutes. On vulnerability assessment, network intrusion, reverse engineering, defacing websites, damaging network appliances, launching distributed denial of service attacks, massive worm propagation, breaking passwords. This is so cool. Now, they're teaching you so you can be a good guy. I want to emphasize that. They also have been doing a lot of interesting stuff around business, about Sigma 6 and stuff like that. So I think this is a very, very good company run by two really great guys, Tim and Don, that I really admire. They copied our model a little bit, and I'm thrilled about it, and I want to encourage you to take a look. They have a trial, low monthly subscription price, no hassle cancellation privacy. Normally it's $57 a month or $570 a year, but there's a special deal right now. If you go to itpro.tv/securitynow, use the offer code SN30, you'll bring it down by 30% for the lifetime of your account, and you get a free 7-day trial. Now, they're introducing a new membership level at the end of this month, on February 1st, so this is kind of urgent. All current premium members as of February 1st will be granted the highest membership level available at the price you sign up at. So to avoid the increase, do it right now. itpro.tv/securitynow. Use the code SN30 and lock in that really great deal. 30% off for the life of your account, no matter what the price is. itpro.tv. They're on the air right now, so when Security Now is over, you can listen to them and learn. And they have the most beautiful studio. I'm so jealous. We went out to visit it. Man, they did a nice job. I hate it when somebody looks better than we do. I'm very jealous. I'm a competitive guy, as you probably know. itpro.tv/securitynow. They are nice guys. I'm not mad at them. All right, Steve, let's talk malware.
Okay, so, yeah. Kevin's article on Daily Beast started with a whole bunch of sort of background stuff that we pretty much know. So I didn't want to drag everyone through it because I wanted to focus on the second portion where he really sort of pulls this down to earth and shares some details. So for example, he writes, the title is How the U.S. Hobbled Its Hacking Case Against Russia and Enabled Truthers. And so he writes, jumping down to the middle, the department released, and he's talking about the Department of Homeland Security and the FBI, this was their joint creation, released 876 internet IP addresses, it says, is linked to Grizzly Step, which we talked about last week, hacking, and urged network administrators everywhere to add the list. Okay, 876 IP addresses to their networking monitoring. Lists of IP addresses, Kevin writes, used by hackers can be useful, quote, indicators of compromise in network security. Admins can check the list against access logs or program an intrusion detection system to sound the alarm when it sees traffic from a suspect address. But that assumes that the list is good, carefully culled, and surrounded with enough context that administrators know what to do when they get a hit. Meaning not just here's a list of 876 bad IP addresses. Kevin writes, the DHS list is none of these things. As Lee, founder of the cybersecurity firm Dragos, discovered, when he ran the list against a stored cache of known clean traffic his company keeps around for testing, the results stunned him. He said, we had thousands of hits. We had an extraordinary high amount of false positives on this data set. Six of them were Yahoo email servers. It turns out that some, perhaps most, of the watch listed addresses have a decidedly weak connection to the Kremlin, if any at all. Kevin writes, in addition to the Yahoo servers, about 44% of the addresses are exit nodes in the Tor anonymity network. Now, I have seen a different number quoted elsewhere. I saw a number of 15%. But still, it's ridiculous to think that Tor exit nodes mean anything. I mean, we know what they are. They're general purpose servers where the traffic is finally decrypted after its last hop through the Tor network and emerges onto the public internet. So, yeah, bad guys use it, but so do all kinds of good people who just would like to have the privilege of anonymity on the internet. So what I got a kick out of was that thanks to Kevin's work, we did get a bit more information about what triggered that Vermont electric utility concern that we discussed last week. He writes, the consequences of the over-inclusive list became apparent last week when a Vermont utility company, Burlington Electric Department, followed DHS's advice and added the addresses to its network monitoring setup, as DHS said to. It got an alert within a day. The utility called the feds. The Washington Post soon broke the distressing news that, quote, Russian hackers penetrated the U.S. electricity grid through a utility in Vermont. Well, of course, we debunked that already last week because it was clearly not the case. And then Kevin says the story was wrong. Not only was the laptop in question isolated from the utility's control systems, the IP address that triggered the alert wasn't dangerous at all. It was one of the Yahoo servers, the Yahoo email servers on the DHS list, and the alert had been generated by a Burlington Electric employee checking his email. The Post article was later corrected, but not before Vermont Senator Patrick Leahy issued a statement condemning the putative Russian attack. Oh, Lord. So anyway, the good news is there's some meat here. Kevin says, but to analysts in the computer security industry, the hackers are old, familiar adversaries. I skipped a bunch of stuff that we are sort of already understand where, you know, they were just talking about how there was way more smoke than substance in this. But he says these hackers are old, familiar adversaries that they, meaning the security industry, have been watching under a microscope for the better part of a decade. The first group, called Fancy Bear, or APT-28, has been active since at least mid-2007. The group typically begins its attacks with targeted spear phishing emails. Oh my God, Leo, I forgot to mention. On Sunday, I heard Reince Priebus, and I didn't verify it, but he did say on national television that John Podesta's email account's password was password.
Yeah, I don't think that's true.
Okay.
I think that's more fake news.
Okay. Good, because...
I'd like to see the verifying document on that.
So we know what spear phishing is. Then the group installs back doors controlled through a cloud of command and control servers deployed around the world. Its targets have included NATO, several U.S. defense contractors, the German parliament, and after Russia's doping scandal began, the World Anti-Doping Agency. One of the command and control servers used in the DNC hack was reportedly also used in the Bundestagend intrusion.
Bundestag.
Thank you.
That's the German parliament.
The other group, commonly called the Dukes or APT-29, was first spotted operating in Chechnya in 2008. Stealthier and more cautious than Fancy Bear, the Dukes have nonetheless been detected infiltrating the White House, the State Department, and the Joint Chiefs of Staff. Known for innovation, one attack campaign used Twitter as a command and control channel. They have their own fleet of customizable malware, including a program called Seaduke, S-E-A-D-U-K-E, that they only bring out for the really important targets, and which was found again on the DNC's network. Security companies, Kevin writes, can tell you much more about these groups, their code, their infrastructures, and their methods. F-Secure has an excellent 34-page write-up of the Dukes, and FireEye has a deep dive into Fancy Bear, among many other reports from different companies on the net. From analysis and the dozens of malware packages used exclusively by these hackers, researchers can tell you that they're usually compiled on machines with the Russian, with the language set to Russian. Both groups operate during working hours in Russia and take Russian holidays off. And these are, of course, attributes that we've talked about in the past as being, you know, signals that are used to give some sense for what's actually going on. Their targets are radically different from those for-profit criminals, hackers in Eastern Europe or anywhere else. No banks, no retailers with credit card numbers to steal, always governments, companies, journalists, NGOs, and other targets that the Russian government would be interested in. In other words, these hackers don't operate like 14-year-olds or, you know, the 400-pound person on the bed. They sometimes use off-the-shelf hacking tools, but more often they deploy industrial-scale malware no teenagers have access to. They hit targets of interest to spies, not kids. And virtually all the public analysis of these two groups concluded, well before it became a political issue with the DNC hack, that they are likely controlled by the Russian government. The evidence, then, that Russia interfered with the election is already solid. Well, okay, to whatever degree that, you know, it mattered. Well, of course, the DNC is part of the election, but okay. And is supported by years of work by the security industry. Lee, again, from Dragos notes, if you've been following along, all the evidence that matters is already public. This is one case out of hundreds that they've investigated involving the same hackers. It's all very, very consistent. It all makes sense. It's all very, very solid, he says. It's just that the government is now confusing everyone. And so in my notes, I wrote, you know, how are we to understand what happened here? You know, and all I can think is perhaps it's a mixture of internet illiterate politicians coupled with the demands of bureaucratic management. You know, it must be that we have, although this would shake anyone's confidence, probably deep within the NSA, skilled professional hackers who know all of this, who are no more happy than the security industry and informed internet savvy people are with this, the nature of this disclosure, which has just mucked everything up. And this must have been, I don't know, like calling most companies and speaking to technical support. We know you're not talking to an expert when you talk to the frontline tech support person. You know, you wind up talking to someone who thinks IP is something that happens when you wake up in the middle of the night rather than, you know, an internet protocol address.
That's a good line. I like, I'm still
That's original. So that's the story with the report. Now, part of that was this, we found some malware. Okay, well, get a load of this. First of all, it's publicly available. The version that they reported, it's known as PAS, and it was they wrote the DHS talked about version 3.1.0, which is relatively old. There is 3.1.7 is freely available, and there's already at a version 4. And it's sort of generic PHP-based malware. So let's step back for a second. You know, we've talked around a lot about PHP and other server-side technologies. Essentially, there's, just to give it a little bit of background, there's sort of three ways to skin the cat of enhancing a web page. You know, without any of that, you end up with the Tim Berners-Lee, you know, click a link, there's a document, and you scroll through it, and it has other hypertext links, which you click, and then it takes you to other linked documents. That was the original web. Of course, then we said, okay, we got to make it do more. So there's the server-side approach, which has two different flavors. There's native code, which is my style. For example, Shields Up, the GRC's e-commerce system, the perfect passwords page, the SSL fingerprints, the cookie forensics, the DNS spoofability, all of those things, those services that I've created over the years are enhancements to the web server. So they're extensions to the web server. In fact, many people have seen ne.dll in the URL. That's my own DLL. NE stands for Net Engine. And so that's that thing. It's my own extension to the Microsoft's IIS server, which has been growing. And the idea is that it can intercept things coming in. So, for example, it sees passwords.htm and on the way to the server, it converts the URL into an ne.dll something in order to access that DLL service on the back end, which then uses a very high quality pseudo random number generator and then presents a static page. And this is the key, a static page customized for that particular instance. So the code running on the back end on the server is involved in dynamically creating the page. It's not just dumping an HTML file from the server's drive out onto the user. So it's involved in doing it on the fly. Then the second approach is to move the dynamicism to the client side. And that's, of course, what scripting, client-side scripting gives us. And of course, I've done that where necessary. The off-the-grid tool that generated Latin squares locally on the user's browser and the password haystacks is a perfect example where as you're typing in, the haystack calculator is showing the alphabet size and the length of time that password current to that keystroke would be updated. So that's JavaScript running in the browser, which is the way you create the greatest level of interactivity. Because, you know, I could have done that but I would have had to have a round trip to GRC and back and be like constantly updating the whole page, which just, you know, isn't the way to do it. The third approach is sort of a compromise, and it's an interesting solution. It's code on the server side, which is interpreted sort of on the way to the user. So there's a static page that the server delivers to this middle layer, which it could be Perl or PHP, Ruby, Java, Python, or even JavaScript on the server side. And so the idea is that something like PHP, it scans the page looking for something that it has to do. There will be a specific escape character sequence that is the key that says, oh, the following is PHP code. So when the PHP interpreter scanning the page sees that, it reads that as code and then executes the code and typically replaces that code with the result of the code execution. So, for example, it might make a SQL database backend query or a bunch of them or do, you know, any amount of work. And so the idea is, as the page is leaving the website, this scripting language, essentially an interpreted scripting language on the server, takes a static page and executes the code in the page, and then what the user gets is the result of that. There's no more PHP anymore, you know, on the page. It's been replaced with whatever that PHP code resolved to. So those are sort of those are the different ways you bring pages alive today. So the server side scripting is a very powerful architecture, and it's clever. You know, I mean, I've had to write native code, well, because I want to, in my case, in assembly language. Apache modules are another example of native server-side extensions. And in fact, those interpreters are implemented as server-side modules of the various servers, if you want to include them in your server. So it's a powerful architecture. It's a nice compromise, because it allows you to have a nice purpose-built language made for, in the case, for example, of PHP, made for expressing web page content rather than a more general purpose language that would provide less help to the author. But it comes with a great responsibility, because now the web page content is being scanned by this extension to the web server for things to do, which it then does on the fly. So this is exactly the same as with all the problems we've talked about with SQL databases over the years, where, for example, web pages would, intended to embed commands to retrieve and display data from back-end SQL databases. But if attackers were ever able to get their own submitted SQL commands to be displayed and interpreted by the web server, commands like drop table can inflict significant damage. So you see what's happening here. The idea is that the way this scripting interpretation works is that the page that's being served contains invocations of the interpreter, which invoke the interpreter to do something. But the danger is, the responsibility is, that it's just web content. So sites that aren't really careful about how they display the web content, if a site blindly takes a blob of text and, as for example, a forum submission, and displays it to the user in front of them, And that display hasn't been filtered for the escape characters to invoke a PHP interpreter, then the PHP interpreter will be invoked and run the code that the bad guy submitted to the forum posting. So while it's powerful, as we always see, with that great power comes great responsibility. And so this is what's tricky about PHP. Now, it's also why it's an attack vector, because if any mistakes are made somewhere, then that provides an opportunity for a bad guy to run their code. And PHP is a powerful language. There is a working implementation of Squirrel in PHP on the server side Squirrel. You can do a lot of things with it. Okay, so specifically, digging into this PAS 3.1.0, having already said, there's not that much special about it. What it is a PHP function which contains an encrypted blob of text, which is decrypted when the attacker supplies the decryption password. After the PHP blob is uploaded to a web server, the attacker accesses the file somehow, and we'll get to that in a second, through a web browser, provides the password, which is then stored as a cookie so that it no longer needs to be re-entered, because PHP is able to look at the site's own cookies as they come and go. And so that allows it to put the password in only once and then use this freely essentially a function enhanced web page. So the blob is decrypted with a password and then executed on the web server. That is, remember, it's executed by the PHP extension, which has a lot of power on the server. So in the case of this PAS 3.1.0, it is what's known as a web shell, which is a multi-purpose, well-known type of toolkit that's often found in forensic examinations. It contains, in this case, a file browser and explorer, allowing a remote attacker to just bring up the contents of the drives that the system has access to and browse around. It's got a file search function, a database client to download the contents of the site's database, network tools, including a port scanner, and the ability to bind a service to a port. So essentially, it's able to create a server on the fly, hooking a service that will then accept incoming traffic, assuming that it's able to get to the server. A tool to brute force attack passwords on FTP and POP3 email. A command line client to run arbitrary operating system commands. I mean, so you could do anything you want with this thing. And a utility to view the server's configuration info in order to get more, glean more information about the site and the way it's configured. And it is freely available on the internet with an optional Bitcoin support donation. The site that offers it has a form you fill out. You put in the password you would like the blob encrypted with, and it then says, okay, here's your download link. You download that, and it is pre-encrypted for you. You arrange somehow to get a site to display it, and when it prompts you for the password, you enter that, and you then have all of those tools at your fingertips. So the remaining question is, how does such malware infect a PHP site like WordPress, which of course is PHP driven? So that's unclear. Nothing in the document that the government provided provided that information. And I would argue maybe they know. Maybe what we're looking at is the result of massive redaction, so that like all of the good stuff was taken out, and because of there was, as we know, a private meeting that both President Obama and President-elect Trump had with the security agencies, which was not made public, and maybe more was like more compelling information was available. But the point that Kevin was making was that we already know all of this. That is, this is not a this wasn't just not an attack by these people only on the DNC. It has been an ongoing campaign for a long time, which with known groups that where there is a strong reason to believe that they are based in Russia. We have to draw the connection to, you know, who supports them and gives them their marching orders. But, you know, all of those things, you know, all of the facts line up. So how does it get in? The guys who have looked at this a lot say that, well, WordPress website owners might have other malware installed on their workstations, and that malware attempts to install PAS, P-A-S, this malware, on their WordPress websites. Maybe a related cross-site request forgery, we've talked about those before, CSRF vulnerability, is used to install the malware. Maybe unwitting users are voluntarily installing this on their own websites after downloading it from a malicious website thinking it's safe. That is like, oh, look, it's password protected. I can do whatever I want to with it. I can, you know, it'll allow me to do things remotely on my own server. Bad idea. Or attackers could be compromising websites through some other means and then using compromised credentials obtained to manually sign in and install PAS with a standard browser. And those sign-ins could be partially or fully automated. So anyway, the bottom line is there is nothing whatsoever particularly impressive or unique about this particular piece of malware. Anybody who wants it could download it by the end of the podcast. It's not clear why DHS and FBI provided it. Maybe they felt they had to provide something.
It was in hexadecimal. It looked really good.
It was gibberish. Leo, it was encrypted. Ooh. It must be. Encryption. All that encrypted stuff.
Yeah.
Yeah. So, you know, that's what we have. I think we have bureaucracy. Maybe the intelligence community is protecting its sources and methods, and we want them to do that. The presumption is, from what we learned from Snowden, there's a lot of stuff with crazy code names that are like, is like, you know, freaky technology that actually exists. We saw pictures of it and we saw slides. So, you know, none of that is represented by this ridiculous report portion that was made public. And it was, you know, unimpressive. But what I think this really says is that, yeah, there is ongoing cyber, I don't want to say warfare, but cyber intrusion. We, the U.S., are probably doing it every bit as much and as successfully as teams in Russia and teams in China and teams in the U.K. and wherever else. That just seems to be something going on. And, you know, in the press, I've been thinking about this. In the press, there's been a lot of like, oh, well, what does this mean? Is this going to be an escalation? Is this the new arms race? Or, you know, and I was thinking, well, you know, the nuclear powers all have nuclear missiles aimed at each other. And, you know, no one has fired them because there just sort of seems to be this, you know, mutual deterrent effect. And meanwhile, we've become globally, thanks to the internet, really closely knit together. I mean, there's, you know, strong financial ties now. And, you know, even though Russia may not need us, well, China buys a lot of Russian energy products and, you know, and we transact a lot with China. So even if it's one step removed, you know, we're connected. You know, nobody wants the economic side to come tumbling down. So I think countries are establishing this technology. They've probably, you know, we call them implants. We probably have implants throughout the critical infrastructures of these other countries. We're doing our best to thwart theirs, but they probably have them too. And this is just sort of the way it's going to be. And meanwhile, the script kiddies, you know, do their script kiddie stuff on an entirely different level than what the state actors are doing. And, you know, we saw sort of a snapshot of it, but it certainly wasn't very impressive.
Well, there you have it. Thank you, Steve Gibson. GRC.com. Everybody should go there and get the latest copy of SpinRite, the world's finest hard drive maintenance and recovery utility. That's Steve's bread and butter.
A couple people did while I
heard the yabba dabba doos.
So thank you, whoever you were.
Keep those yabba dabbas coming. You can also get the podcast there. He has audio and transcripts at GRC.com and lots of free stuff. I mean, it's a great site for, it's just a treasure trove. You can just browse your little heart out there. GRC.com. We have audio and video at our site, too, of course, twit.tv/SN. And we put it on YouTube. By the way, we're on YouTube Live now. If you go to youtube.com/twit, you can watch the live stream there as well as on our website, as well as using those apps. There's so many apps. There's like five or six apps on Apple TV. All of them have live streaming. Or get the, you know, show after the fact, watch on YouTube or download. I think downloading is the best thing to do. Whatever. It's, you know, we don't care how you get it. Just get it. You don't want to miss a single episode of this show. We record on the air, so you can watch it if you want live every Tuesday. Tuesday at 1:30. I have to think. What day is this? Tuesday at 1:30 Pacific, 4:30 p.m. Eastern time, 21:30 UTC. And you just, you know, go watch the live stream and you'll see a little bit different version of the show than when we put out, but it's pretty much the same thing. You can also, let's see, what else? Get the app and subscribe. You'll have a collection. There's lots of ways to play. Steve, back next week, and we're going to do questions, right?
I'm not sure. I've got a bunch of topics to talk about. I'm sort of a couple of people have suggested that I sort of fold some in as I did this time. Some feedback from our listeners. Yeah. So when it's topical and it makes sense, but maybe we'll do a Q&A. I'll check the mailbag, and if it's compelling, that'll sell me.
Okay. You can the mailbag really isn't a mail or a bag. It's you go to grc.com/feedback and you can leave a comment there. Or really, I think most people now use Twitter. Steve's Twitter handle at SGGRC. At SGGRC. Thanks, Steve. We'll see you next time on Security Now.
Thanks, Leo. Security.